Colonel Michael Dimitriadi, Reel 3.
David was hit in the head and seemed to fall, but nobody ever got to him. And so we did not know exactly what had happened, and he was not allowed the possibility of a posthumous Victoria Cross, which he had so richly deserved, and for which he was originally recommended. At that time, there was a thought throughout the army, at any rate, that if a person, being officer or other rank, was missing, even though believed killed, he might not have been killed and might have been taken prisoner. And at that time, it was considered incorrect that anybody who was taken prisoner could receive an award such as the Victoria Cross. Eventually, David was given the, what at that time was the only possible alternative posthumous decoration, a mention in dispatches, which greatly disgusted his father and us. One other officer, young John Rostron, had done extremely well and got onto his objective with a few men. He couldn't do more than remain where he was with the men of his company, and so our colonel, Humphrey Williams, got hold of the loudspeakers of the propaganda unit. This propaganda unit had been set up to broadcast over the battlefield to the Japs with such useless sort of broadcasts as, you might as well give up, all is lost, and this and the other, something which did no good at all. But Humphrey got hold of these things, set them up, and broadcast in Welsh over the battlefield, firstly asking people to identify their positions and their strengths by rifle shots, and secondly giving them instructions in Welsh as to how to withdraw and rally back. This was highly successful, and young John Rostron eventually was awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his efforts. The attack had failed, and the Royal Scots were instructed to put in an attack that night to try and achieve the objectives which the Royal Welsh Fusiliers had failed to do. It was a wonderful sound to hear the pipes urging the Royal Scots forward, but their attack was no more successful than the Royal Welsh, and it was aborted before it had got very far. Meanwhile, on the left, the DLI had made some advance and had got to their positions, but they were eventually taken back a bit to hold the line a little bit behind the points which they had reached. They, too, had had considerable casualties.
What were your casualties?
We lost something like 13 officers and 150 other ranks. The officer decimation was really appalling because most of the platoon commanders were either killed or seriously wounded. And we had to do a considerable reorganization after that terrible day. A couple of days later, the Padre, Kenneth Parkhurst, who'd been a tower of strength throughout, held a very moving service. And in due course, reinforcements arrived from the rear. These were not a great success. Many of them were untrained, and even including the officers, were not wholly successful. About this time, I had, as intelligence officer, the duty of inspecting captured enemy equipment and so on, and one of the pieces that I was looking at was a Japanese grenade, which I had defused, but unfortunately the detonator went off and I got wounded in the leg. This wasn't too bad, but a day or two later I had a recurrence of malaria, which I had before, and it was decided that I should be evacuated to hospital, or dressing station at least. So I was put on in an ambulance and carted back over the very rough terrain to Teknaf with some wretched Indian soldier, and the stretcher below me in the ambulance kicking me in the back all the way, which wasn't much fun. But we got to Tekdaf, and we put on the decks of a sort of barge-like vessel, which was to take us across to Chittagong. And there we were, lying on our stretchers on the decks, when the Jap Air Force decided to come over and have a go at us. Luckily, they missed us, but all the Indian orderlies looking after us leapt overboard. So we wouldn't have had much chance if the Japanese had been more accurate with their strafing.
What was morale like at that time? You know, that must have been an important defeat in a way.
That is very difficult to tell. I mean, the morale of the battalion before it went into action was extremely high because it felt itself very well trained. I think they realized they'd done pretty well afterwards, but naturally there's an awful lot of sadness at the failure to achieve our objective and the number of lives lost. I wouldn't have said the morale was bad at that stage, but there was a certain amount of despondency, inevitably.
Is the Japanese sound a very formidable foe, the way you were saying that they were dug in and they could even support from other positions without injuring their own men?
Absolutely. This is a characteristic of all the fighting against the Japanese. They were, in fact, very brave soldiers, if some of them weren't very intelligent. We never took a Japanese prisoner all that time. And later on, we took very, very, very few. A Japanese, even if wounded, would probably blow himself up with a grenade rather than let himself be captured.
Did you have facilities at Dombike, you know, for the wounded?
We had a regimental aid post, the normal regimental aid post, and from there they were evacuated to an advanced dressing station, and from there to a hospital somewhere. I think I went back to a hospital at Camilla. I can't actually remember, but I wasn't away very long. But having arrived in hospital with leg wounds and malaria, they didn't know whether to put me into a surgical ward or a medical ward, which was quite I can't remember what the outcome was. But anyway, I was away within about a month and back with the battalion. But during that time that I was away, a very unfortunate episode took place in a place called In Vin, which was north of Dombike, where our brigade headquarters was established. And word had come that the Japanese were infiltrating to the west across the Bayou Ridge to cut off our brigade. And the DLI and ourselves, Royal Fusiliers, were ordered back to defend this. The Royal Marches were already in a rearward position, and the Royal Scots were near the brigade headquarters at In Vin. What I have to say about that battle can't be from my own experience, because I was in hospital, but I have read so many papers. I have the advantage of having the daily personal diary written by Colonel Williams, and other reports, the war diary, which was kept by my own intelligence section, the appendices in it, and various books which I have read. And I believe that the story I have to tell about Indian is the true one. I can't believe that it could be any other way. And indeed, it has been endorsed. My account has been endorsed by Brigadier Cavendish's son, Major General Peter Cavendish, as being the best and most authoritative account that he has read. Well, on the Japanese attack on the brigade headquarters, shortly before the Japanese overran the headquarters, the brigadier knew that he was virtually surrounded and had very little chance of escape. And he got on the wireless to the CO of the 130, I think it was, field regiment, who was supporting us, and who at that time was south of In Vin, between our Royal Fusiliers and DLI going back, and In Vin with the brigade headquarters, and the Royal Scots north of that. And he told the Sierra that they had very little chance of getting away from this situation, and that he was to, the Sierra of the field regiment was to take charge of the troops south of the brigade quarters, and he was to order the Sierra of the DLI to take charge of the troops north once he got there. And in the meantime, any movement on the brigade headquarters was to be considered as hostile and was to be shelled. From what one understands from Japanese accounts and from the accounts of our own officers who were either present there or closely associated with what was going on there, this is exactly what happened. The brigade headquarters was surrounded by Japanese. The brigade major and his brigadier and perhaps one other officer were led away by the Japanese. W. Reese, the brigade intelligence officer, feigned death and although wounded eventually managed to get away and come back to us. And as the Japanese were taking away the brigadier and his staff, our own artillery opened up on the position, and in addition to wounding the Japanese officer commanding, killed Brigadier Cavendish and Major Fanshawe, his chief staff officer, his brigade major. It has been said that the Japanese were taunting us to fire at them. I do not personally believe that that was the case, but it's not possible for me to say with any certainty because I wasn't there.
Was there any air support during this battle of Dombike?
Yes, there was a little. I can't really speak much about it because I wasn't involved in the plan of what the Air Force had to do. They did, however, unfortunately, wound and kill one or two of our own people, and I don't quite know how much damage they may have done to the Japanese, but I couldn't say that in my observation the Air Force figured very largely, although undoubtedly there were Air Force personnel involved, both on the ground and in the air.
It seems from how you described the Japanese positions, you know, their bunkers, and the very clever camouflage, that they would be very difficult to spot from the air.
I think that's true. That's probably why we got the benefit of the RAF rather than the Japanese did. I don't entirely blame them for that. I think it was very, very difficult indeed. We hadn't developed any sort of target indication methods to tell the Air Force exactly where they should make their attack. And then even if we had, I think it was everything was so close together that it would be a very difficult task indeed for them to do more than they did.
Yes. Do you also think the Japanese, their personal clothing was very effective given the terrain of Burma? Did they have an advantage over the British and the Indian armies, would you say?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think our clothing was fairly similar on both sides. When we first went abroad, we were issued with the most ridiculous garment, which was what we would call a long short. Khaki shorts, which came down to the knee and then folded back up to the waist to be held at the waist of the button. You can imagine how smart that might look, sagging at the back, and when unfolded, enormously voluminous around the ankles. And it's the most impractical garment that was ever devised, and we got rid of those fairly quickly and got ordinary trousers. Because one of the biggest troubles we had was malaria. We had probably as many casualties, if not more casualties, from malaria throughout the Burma campaign as we ever had from enemy action. And it is very difficult when you're living in a jungle or a slip trench or something like that to go to bed and effectively enclose yourself in some sort of mosquito net. So that was rather abandoned, and we didn't bother with mosquito nets. But it was important not to have uncovered flesh. And so the Eustace long shorts were luckily dispensed with before we got there. We had ordinary trousers. Furthermore, we had mepocrine tablets, which we were supposed to take to guard against malaria. These were rather suspected by the soldiers, who thought it might affect their potency.
Did that mean they wouldn't take them for that reason?
Well, they had to be supervised to make sure they did take them. In the same way, they had to be supervised to make sure that they had they took salt tablets to avoid heat exhaustion. And eventually what we used to do was put a salt tablet in each man's water bottle as it was filled up, and he got it that way. But we did have at least one death from heat exhaustion later on in the war.
You will tell me about that later.
Nothing much more to add. I mean, he just died of heat exhaustion, because it's a strange thing. In the old days in the army in those parts of the world, one had spine pads to keep the sun off the back of your neck, because that was supposed to be bad for you. We had Woolsey helmets, which were great, big, thick, heavy cork helmets, and then there was a lighter version called a topi. And then, before we left India to go to Arakan, we had a thing called the Bombay Bowler, which was a very light thing that didn't... Well, like it's not like the old-fashioned solar topi, but it was supposed to keep off the effects of the sun. But after one had become acclimatized, one went about with no head covering at all, except a tin hat when things became a bit hairy. And in fact, the last thought to avoid sunstroke was to wear dark glasses. I don't remember anyone ever doing so, but I think that was the thinking at the time. But I certainly went about without any sort of head covering after a year or two in those conditions. An amusing thing about the various headgears that we did wear, when it was a solar topi or a Bombay bowler, these particular forms of headgear had what was known as a pugri, which was a cloth wound round and round just at the above the brim and below the crown. And Royal Fusiliers had a particular form of wind of this pugri. It had to be wound on in a certain manner. And I learnt to do this and became very much in demand for winding pugris onto other people's solar topis to conform to the regimental pattern. I enjoyed that.
Very interesting you talking about the propaganda business and the uselessness of this, you know, in this particular, in the case that you were describing so well. Could you tell me anything more about this and, you know, how it was used in other areas?
I never came across it used in other areas, so I believe it happened in Eritrea. His name was Major George Steer. And I subsequently was asked by a person who was writing his history to give my thoughts on his account of the man and what he was doing, but I have never seen the final result.
And he was just sort of talking through this loudspeaker, was he?
Yes.
Trying to break Japanese morale.
I think that was the idea, in the same way as the Japanese had Tokyo Rose, who used to broadcast to the British soldiers, in particular to try and activate the Indian Liberation Army, the ILA, under Chandra Bose. So, after Indian, the brigade was withdrawn and went back to India. And one of the first things, of course, was to try and rid us of our malaria. And we were sent up to a place called Mahableshwar, where it was very cold, and we did some fairly rugged training. Before Royal Welsh went to Mahableshwar, we went back to our old camp at Ahmednagar, and in the meantime, our 2nd Battalion of Royal Welsh Fusiliers, in 29 Independent Brigade, had carried out the Madagascar operation, and from there had come on to India, and were in training round about Pune. The two battalions met twice, which is rather an infrequent occurrence between regular battalions of a regiment. Firstly, in Ahmednagar, the 2nd Battalion came to see us, and we played rugger against them, we played soccer against them. I don't think the 1st Battalion won, but we then went down to Pune and had a return match there with a very splendid officers' dinner for the officers of both battalions in the, I think it was in the turf club in Pune. And I have a menu signed by many of the of those present. About this time, we had a very unfortunate experience, at least I think it was. When we had gone down to the Don Bike operation, we were commanded, as I mentioned, by Humphrey Williams, a territorial officer. As a result of the casualties in France, in the VEF, the 1st Battalion at this time had no regular officers in it whatsoever. Humphrey Williams was a territorial officer commanding the battalion. We had one other territorial officer. The commanding officer immediately for Humphrey Williams, who'd taken us to India, the one who'd taught us Arabic and Urdu on the ship, was Brigadier Basil Colonel Basil Hopkins, who was from the Regular Army Reserve of Officers, who'd been recalled from the war. And just before we went down to the Don Bike battle, had been moved to the headquarters of 6th Infantry Brigade as the brigade second in command. And Humphrey Williams had taken over the command of the battalion from having been second in command. So there we were, a regular battalion with no regular officers in it. By contrast, the 2nd Battalion, whose action in the war so far had been limited to the attack in Madagascar, where I don't think they had any casualties, still had plenty of regular officers in it. And to our amazement, really, the first thing that happened was that we were sent a battalion second in command from the 2nd Battalion to be our second in command, Major John Vaughan. A delightful chap, a pre-war regular, but not, I would say, the most able fighting soldier. He was shortly followed by Colonel Garnet Braithwaite, who was sent to be our new CO, and Colonel Humphrey Williams was actually, he resigned. For some while, we've been trying to work out, some of us, why he resigned. We know that from his own personal diary that when he was put in command, he had certain doubts about whether he would be acceptable in the battalion. He was acceptable. He was a superb leader of men. Although I remember one night in Chittagong when we'd had mail, before we did Dunbike, we had mail from home and Humphrey was sitting reading by light of a halogen lamp. And he suddenly said, "Good God." And I said, "Humphrey, what's the trouble?" He said, "The children are starting to speak English." But there he was, a wonderful man. But he had these doubts about whether he ought to command or was fit to command. We don't know why. He never explained it. But back in India, he resigned. A lot of his officers went to see the general and tried to get it withdrawn, and was told it was too late. But the general would see to it that he did not lose his rank. And Humphrey went home to England and did lose his rank. He became a major again. And it was some while before, in the Second Front, with one of the territorial battalions, he regained command. But not for very long, because he was wounded for about the third time. But the arrival of Garnet Braithwaite made a great worry for us. Garnet was a big man, a brave man, but he suffered badly from a stutter, which impaired his authority, I think. And the first thing he did was to go round the various officers in the battalion saying, you are the loyal officer. Well, what a thing to say to people. I mean, some of them were very upset at the way Humphrey had been shifted. Garnet apparently had come with ideas that some of the officers ought to be removed, and a number of officers, some of our better officers, did in fact leave, including my great friend Martin Lloyd Davis, who had been adjutant throughout the Arakan campaign. At that time, in the 1st Battalion, we reckoned we were the battalion who knew how to fight, and the 2nd Battalion was the battalion who knew how to put on the spit and polish. I think that's unfair, but anyway, that's the way we looked at it. The sort of thing that happened was this, that we would go out under Garnet Braithwaite on an exercise in the field, and he would insist upon the officers' mess being brought out and set up. Well, we'd be fighting battles and be eating with our men and whatever came, and we were actually forbidden to have food with our men, which annoyed us quite considerably. This was the sort of thing that really got against us. Up in Mahabaleshwar, where we had been sent to get cool and fit again, I found it very difficult working in the battalion with this man, and I got myself sent to the intelligence school Karachi as on an intelligence course, where I had a very pleasant time revisiting what had been our home in the early 20s, going to see the Sindh Club, of which my father had been a founder member, and taking part in a regatta on the river, in which I was fortunate enough to win 2 out of my 3 races. But returning to the battalion, it wasn't long before I was posted to headquarters of the 6th Brigade as a brigade intelligence officer. W. Reese had been, as I mentioned, wounded at Indin, and to be frank, I can't remember who was there in the meantime, but anyway, there I was as brigade intelligence officer and left the battalion behind. Well, then we had the orders to go to Dimapur for the attack, for the defence of Kohima and Indin.
Before we go there, could I ask you something about the training as an intelligence officer? You obviously started this in the UK and continued it in this course in Karachi. What sort of things were you being told or educated into?
Learning how to write appreciations of what the enemy might do, learning something about their organization and tactics and weaponry, a lot about how to write orders and things of that sort.
Was there good information coming in about the Japanese?
I suppose what there was of it was quite good. I don't think there was a great deal about it. It was very much a question of how to produce proper paperwork for generals and so on to appreciate what the situation was.
Is the situation in the field? Mm. Were you involved with that at all?
Oh yes, very much so. That was the whole point of it.
Yes, I was wondering, the situation with radios in some of the areas, like particularly jungle, if there was any problem and whether there was a dearth of radio communication.
Radios didn't always work in the jungle. We didn't have the modern equivalents. There were heavier sets. For any long-distance radios, they had to be carried on mules or something of that sort, because they were too heavy for men to carry. And if you hadn't got mules, you hadn't got radios. If a mule went over the side of the hill with a radio on its back, that was the end of your radio. But my job, when we got to Dimapur as brigade intelligence officer, was really to keep the brigadier and the general, if need be, informed as to what the battle was doing amongst our own troops and what the enemy appeared to be doing opposite us, so that they could form some sort of plan. And at one time, I had the satisfaction of having under me an intelligence officer from another unit, not a British unit, who had been a senior boy in my house when I was a young boy in the school. I was quite pleased to that he'd come under my control, although a bit miffed when later on he got an MBE and I didn't.